Welcome to Conversations with Owens Community College President, Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Welcome to today's episode of the Conversations Podcast. I'm Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Thank you for listening today. Whether this is your first time with us or if you're a longtime follower, we're so happy that you're joining us as we explore the issues and meet the people who are important to Northwest Ohio and to Owens Community College. Thank you for listening today. Please enjoy our previous episodes and subscribe to Conversations to join us for future episodes. Today, I am so excited to welcome Dr. Brian Treese, President and CEO of the Finley Hancock Community Foundation. A lifelong resident of Finley, Dr. Treese graduated from Finley High School before earning both a bachelor's and master's degree in education from the University of Finley. He went on to complete his doctorate in organizational leadership from North Central University. After serving as Assistant Dean of Students at the University of Finley, he joined the Finley Hancock Community Foundation in 2016. He was a Program Director for Community and Organizational Development and Evaluation, and then became the Foundation's President and CEO in November of 2020. In the community, he has been involved with Hancock Leadership, Hancock Youth Leadership, the Center for Civic Engagement, Gliding Stars, Hancock Federal Credit Union, the Arts Partnership, Cancer Patient Services, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, and he has volunteered for a wide variety of community events, including being a six-time chair of the Finley Hancock County Halloween Parade. Hi, Dr. Treese. Thank you for being our guest today. Brian, welcome to the Conversations Podcast. I'm so excited for our talk today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, one of the things that we ask every guest is, what was it that made you know that you wanted higher education? What was that moment like for you?
The earliest memory that I have when I started solidifying what I wanted to be when I grew up was second grade. And two things happened at the same time. My mom got a job as a school secretary at one of the highest need schools in Finley. And before and after the school year, I think partially for childcare reasons, but I like to think because I was such a great kid, I would go to the school and help teachers, help with bulletin boards, grading papers, preparing classrooms. That combined with a phenomenal second grade teacher, Mrs. Julie Miller, who I talk about very often, those two things let me know that I wanted to be a teacher.
That is so awesome.
And while I had some dabbling in other careers, starting in second grade, I knew I wanted to be a teacher. And I knew that to do that, I needed to go on to college. And secure a bachelor's degree. And so that was the very earliest time, and it was very young, second grade. But from then on, I knew that that was my pathway.
Isn't that something?
So young, so early.
Well, you know, you're a quick study there.
I attribute it to all of the great teachers that I have been exposed to in my life because I never wavered. That's what I saw myself doing from the beginning.
That speaks so much to the environment, who we have contact with, people who serve as mentors in our lives. It's pretty incredible.
And I would say none of them knew at the time the profound effect they were having on me. When they reluctantly agreed to let me help in their classroom, they didn't know that that was shaping what I wanted to do for my future.
Do they know now?
They do. I tell them often. The ones that are still with us. And it even shaped what grades I wanted to teach. Kindergarten and second grade were my two preferred grades because of specific teachers. And my mom, when she accepted that job, had no idea that her working in that school would give me a passion for education, but also teach me about poverty, hunger, and helping people. None of that was in the cards when it first happened.
That is amazing. So you went to the University of Finley to earn your bachelor's in education, and then you decided to continue to get a master's. So tell me about that path.
So I went to Finley, and like most people, you never think you're going to your hometown. But back in those days, there was a program called Post-Secondary Options.
PSEO.
Yes, which is where high school students could go to a college and take class. Very similar to programs they have now, but this was in the infancy. From that moment, they say, and we tell students that when you figure out what campus you belong on, you will just know. And I remember that experience as a high school junior, walking onto the campus, and all of a sudden it was no other campus mattered. This was where I was meant to be. So I did a bachelor's degree and wanted to be a teacher, student taught with second grade. And before my senior year, the University of Finley, my mentor, Dave, Mm-hmm. Emsweller approached me and said, would you be willing to come work for University of Findlay mm-hmm. and earn a master's degree for free?
Sounds like a good deal.
Knowing I wanted to be a teacher and knowing what school cost, I said, sure. And earned a master's degree, earned everything except for the experience for my principal's licensure, and kept going. And in the meantime, I learned that I loved higher education. Mm-hmm. And I loved working with college students as well. And looking at career paths, I wanted a master's because to become a principal or to become a superintendent, you need a master's. Then working in higher education, I knew that to be a vice president or to be a president of a university, you needed a doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
That combined with, I was the first person in my immediate family. I'm first generation college student, mm-hmm. but then in my larger family, I'm the very first to get a doctorate. And I set that goal for myself very quickly. In college, I had about 10 cousins that were under the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really important for me to show them a path.
Right.
Included a doctorate. So I'm very, very proud of that. And, mm-hmm. and one of my cousins recently earned her doctorate. And the first thing she said to me was, you're not the only doctor in the family anymore. And that was such a cool moment because I am so proud of her. And for all of them, for chasing whatever dream it is that they had.
Absolutely.
That's a big moment when you see somebody grow up and do what they aspired to do.
That speaks so much to your ability to be a role model and how you take that responsibility on behalf of your cousins. Because, I mean, clearly that wasn't something you had to do, but it was very meaningful to you for your career, for your own purposes, but also what you could demonstrate to all of them.
And I have to admit, I've heard you ask this question before, but I don't know your answer to it. So when did you first know that you were going to pursue higher education?
I didn't have a choice. It never was, Dion, what are you going to do after high school? Or Dion, if you choose to go to college, it was Dion, when you leave high school and go to college, then da 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 da. And so there was never kind of a pause or an interim moment in there. And so it was always kind of the expectation. And I never really thought or tested or really considered any path other than, you know, like we all knew people, like when I, you know, at the time I came out of school, you knew people who either went into the military or directly into the world of work or whatever. And it was just always in my mind and apparently also in my family's mind, a foregone conclusion that I was going directly to college.
What are some of your first recollections of what you wanted to be? Obviously, I don't know that this was on your radar mm-hmm. at a young age, but when did you know this was your path?
This was never on my path as a young person. I think there's a difference between kind of some of that early childhood thoughts about possibilities and careers versus true career exploration. I will tell you that when I went to college the first time, my goal was to be the team doctor for the Detroit Pistons. I was biochemistry pre-med. That's what I was set to do. I realized pretty quickly that that probably wasn't aligned with my strengths. And so changed majors and eventually became an English writing major. I didn't realize higher education as a career path until I was in college. And I don't think that that's uncommon for people. Just like you had that experience of being in college, and that's when you had said, okay, I really like being in higher ed. I think that only if you are somehow related to someone or, you know, have some sort of other exposure, that's when you know that being in higher education is right. really a career path, and particularly anything outside of the, you know, the faculty ranks, because everyone knows about faculty because they have that experience in education. They don't know about all of the other careers. And so that's something where you and I have in common, that you and I both started our professional careers working in student affairs in higher education. And so talk to me a little bit about how that part of your career took off, because there had to be a decision point when you decided to pivot. And you talked about how you knew you wanted to, you know, consider being a principal. And so you knew you needed the master's, but that wasn't a second grade teacher. And so right. can you talk a little bit about that decision making and that changing of your mind?
Just like you said, you have no idea that higher education is a career choice. I started as an RA mm-hmm. and involved in a fraternity and student government, and mentors that I interacted with who this was their job, they started talking about their career path and how they could do this for work. And mm-hmm. I've been lucky in my career, throughout my career, that there are times that I've had a job that you almost pinch yourself. Like, this is for real my mm-hmm. job. This is what I earn a living doing. And I'll say about 5 years into my time at University of Findlay is when I really had that conscious decision that I can still love pre-K through 12 education mm-hmm. and realize this is my home for now,
yeah.
working with college students. And I think it happened when I started seeing impact mm-hmm. and seeing when students would come in, and I'm sure you experienced and still experience this, those life conversations that you have with students that aren't just about whatever the problem of the day is or whatever the obstacle, but it's that bigger aha moment mm-hmm. where you realize what I'm saying is having a bigger influence than I ever expected. Right. And that's why I think people get into higher ed, because that's powerful. You're talking about career, you're talking about life, you're talking about the kind of people that they hope to be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Very few places do you get to do that mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And it's powerful, enjoyable. So yeah, that's about when I had that decision-making moment.
And you realize too that you're speaking with someone who is an adult. Depending on the age group that they belong to, they're anywhere on that continuum, but they're an adult. And so they have a level of ownership, participation, and engagement in this set of life choices that sometimes you don't have, or I'm assuming you don't have, with other age groups.
The conscious choice to be there, mm-hmm. that sacrifice that so many students, we don't often talk about the sacrifice that students make mm-hmm. when they decide to pursue education,
mm-hmm.
because it takes incredible amounts of perseverance, grit, mm-hmm. time, the financial resources, and they're making these sacrifices,
mm-hmm.
and they're choosing to be there, mm-hmm. choosing to overcome whatever it is, whatever bumps on the road got them there, and that's special mm-hmm. to be a part of that, where they are committed to doing this work. It's not compulsory. It's something they choose to do.
Absolutely. So is it a leap to say that some of that same ethic of care, the excitement for helping people transcend, helping people reach their goals, that's part of what you took with you to the Findlay-Hancock County Foundation?
Definitely. Definitely. I learned so much for my time at University of Findlay. And I use those skills, and I've built upon those skills every single day in the work that we get to do now.
Can you tell people, I don't know that everyone knows what a community foundation is. Can you tell people what exactly it is?
Sure. That is very common, by the way, especially when I told my family I'm moving from a university to the community foundation. They were great. We're so excited. What does that mean? So I'll explain a couple of different ways. Community foundations exist to serve a specific population.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, it's Findlay and Hancock County, which means you look at the Hancock County boundaries, and that's our service region.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we work with donors and we pool those resources. You'll hear me talk about the terms forever and in perpetuity. We take those gifts and we invest them. And then we have a portion of those get allocated every year. So right now our spending policy dictates 4.5%. So it's that idea of somebody makes a gift, we invest the gift and pool it with other gifts. And then we are able to follow donor directions or follow donor intent to make an impact forever. And so right now our assets are over $209 million that we have been trusted with through the years. And every year we're able to grant millions of dollars out to meet donor intent, whether that be education, whether that be, you know, parks, community mental health, housing, all of these different functions. We're able to do that because donors have trusted us with those resources through the years. And now we will be able to do that forever.
That is wonderful.
We talk in our field about community foundations are places where people who love their communities mm-hmm. are never forgotten by mm-hmm. their communities. It's that idea, because the gift is forever, every single year the beneficiaries will receive a check. And in that memo line will be that donor's name. And that's powerful. You know, we talk about love stories mm-hmm. and the work that we do. And it's not the Hallmark style. It's, you know, we're not going to go on a farm and, you know, meet somebody long lost. It's that idea that somebody had such a love mm-hmm. for their community that they wanted to make sure that the impact would be felt forever.
That is amazing. You have a current campaign right now.
We do.
And it's called Rooted to Rise. Talk to me a little about that. The little bit that I know about this is absolutely amazing.
This directly comes from our community and what our community has said their priorities are. And we have them divided into two sections, work and play. Mm-hmm. And work looks at childcare, housing, transportation, and workforce. Mm-hmm. Play focuses on arts, the parks, recreation, and fun-free community activities, or what we call fun for all. Mm-hmm. And we have both involved because work and play are really two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. Work is about survival. And if you focus on just work, you're surviving. You're worrying about where you're going to live, how you pay the bills, getting to and from the places you need to. That's survival. Play is about thriving. And the research shows that play is such an essential part of what we do. So we needed to include it because it's really important for our community to focus on, yes, work is critical, but play is important too. So over the next 2 years, we will be highlighting each of those eight areas. Right now, we're talking a lot about housing. We're going to move at the end of this calendar year about fun-free community activities and then childcare early 2026. And then we'll go from there.
Well, yeah, one of the things that I absolutely love about the initiative is that it seems so incredibly comprehensive and holistic. And at least, you know, it seems like the whole Findlay community in Hancock County is centered on all of these same things.
Yes, I think one of the things that makes our community unique, I will say none of these issues or priorities are necessarily unique. Mm-hmm. But what is unique is our approach. Mm-hmm. And over a decade ago, our community, the United Way, the Community Foundation, the city all came together and said, we consciously want to take a coalition or a collective approach mm-hmm. to these problems. So through the years, each of those have had a coalition established. We have mm-hmm. Raise the Bar, which looks at workforce, which I know you're really involved in. The newest one is our Childcare Collaborative. And each of them have a collection or a collective working on the problem because we know that systems level problems are complex. They involve a lot of partners. They have a variety of solutions. They're expensive to address, and they take a long time to see results. With coalitions addressing them, we get everybody involved in the same room and start talking about gap analysis. Where are the things that we need to address incrementally or step by step to see change? And we've seen results. Mm-hmm. We've seen results. And that's, I think, what makes Findlay and Hancock County unique, is that we're taking this collaborative approach and we're seeing results from it.
I've even heard Mayor Mearn talk about how housing isn't separate from workforce development. Even the child care issue, I know that the lead of our child care center on our Findlay campus is involved in that initiative. I mean, there really is a level of recognition of the interdependence
yes.
of all of these things to create a vibrant community, to have quality of life, and that they're all kind of coming together with some alignment to move towards a concerted effort for Findlay and Hancock County.
And it's the idea that a rising tide lifts all ships. So we know that thousands of people every day drive to Hancock County to work because they cannot find housing in Hancock County. So if they found housing in Hancock County, their work life would be more secure. If they found reliable transportation, that would impact work. Childcare would impact work. All of these things, they're so interconnected, mm-hmm. and any one change for the better would change the rest uh-huh. for the better, which is what makes the work interesting and fun. And when we look, this is our most ambitious campaign we've ever done. Uh-huh. Typically, we focus on one area, like youth or mental health. This is a lift for us because our community told us it's important.
And so you do these road shows relatively often to get information from the community, figure out how the foundation can be best positioned to meet the community needs. Am I remembering that right?
Yes. So community conversations every 3 to 4 years. So our first was in 2018, and it was one of my first years being at the Community Foundation. And we are doing our role, our best, when we hear from the people that we serve. And it's really simple. It sounds very complex, but it's very simple. Mm-hmm. We ask questions and listen. And we are fortunate that the community has shared. And what I found most interesting, probably a little naively the first time, is when we were having these conversations, and we did them tabletop where we get 10 people together, everybody was talking about the same thing. I would talk to corporate executives, kids in a school, residents at the county jail, and everybody's talking about housing, transportation, workforce, across the board. While it impacts them differently, that was the part that really was profound to me. And then when we repeated it immediately after the pandemic around 2021, we found the same things, except for we added childcare and we added health equity because the pandemic really highlighted that there were inequities in healthcare. And I'm excited to say that we are doing our third round right now. We started about a week ago. And we're doing it slightly different. Instead of tabletop conversations, we're going to existing community events and having participants go on a bit of a data walk where they share some thoughts and ideas in a very low touch, low time commitment way to make sure we're still on the right track and to get ideas, which it's fun. Hopefully you'll be able to attend one. It's really rewarding to hear people talking about not only what they love about the community, but the challenges that we face and potential ways we can address them.
You had mentioned that while some of the priorities of the Rooted to Rise initiative may not be unique, that Finley's approach to it is unique. Mm-hmm. And so as a lifelong resident of Finley, can you talk a little bit about Finley, the character of the community, and what makes it unique in your eyes?
There are a couple beliefs that I have that have been reinforced through my time. First, I'm a firm believer we are at our strongest when we work together. Second, there is nothing that we cannot accomplish if we're all on the same page working together. And I've seen it. I've seen it through the years. Finley-Hancock County has had some flooding concerns in the past, and it started when I was 2 or 3 years old, my first memory of a flood, all the way through our historic flood several years ago. When we come together, we help each other and we work through it and we look at the root causes of flooding and look at benching, look at, you know, dredging rivers and look at all of those different solutions. I saw we had the Argyle Fire, which was a large building downtown that was largely serving individuals at a lower socioeconomic level. Mm-hmm. And so when that fire devastated that building, all of a sudden, a group of people that were vulnerable already were unhoused. Mm. And I saw our community rally to help those individuals. I saw it with the derecho, where we had straight line winds that caused significant damage. I saw our community rally then. I see it in big and small ways every single day, how when we choose to and we rally around something, we can move mountains.
That is absolutely amazing. It's interesting because when I think of my own personal experiences in Finley, there's always been that sense of warmth kind of coming around to, you know, to take care of one another. And that's pretty amazing.
It makes it a special place. Mm-hmm. Just like I'm sure everybody has fond memories of the place that they call home or the place that they grew up.
Absolutely. In the past, you have called local nonprofits the heartbeat of Hancock County. You care to elaborate on what you mean for that?
We are so incredibly fortunate to have the nonprofits that we do in Finley and Hancock County. When you think about sectors as a whole, the not-for-profit or nonprofit sector touches every single citizen on a consistent and regular basis, whether it be healthcare, education, the arts, social services, hunger, and they do so in typically very stressful situations. When you think some of the nonprofits serve our most vulnerable population and they serve at a time of crisis, and the people who work there or who volunteer there serve every day. They serve in stressful situations and tight budgets. They run their business and serve people in really admirable ways. And there are trying times, and the burnout is real with nonprofits. You see, nationally, I saw a statistic that executive directors at nonprofits are leaving at a higher rate than ever before. And it's burnout and the lack of consistent finances that are doing it. And so I feel any chance that we have the opportunity to talk about the not-for-profit or nonprofit sector, we need to. And we need to thank the people, the board members, the volunteers, the staff, and the directors that every single day are making a positive difference for the people they serve.
Well, it's just so amazing what you're doing and what the foundation is doing, because when you talk about how it touches everyone, there's a level of need, there's a level of life integration, there's a level of urgency to a lot of the initiatives that you have, because you're able to help people be better versions of themselves. You're able to help them with basic needs so that they can actually provide a life for themselves, so that they're no longer worried about basic needs. I mean, there's a lot of things that are part of that that you're able to do that really kind of helps people live a certain quality of life that they may not have been able to without what the foundation does.
And we're only able to because of our partners, because we have such fantastic nonprofits, dedicated donors. I don't serve the hungry. I don't meet that need, but I can support the nonprofits that do that as their mission. Our mission is to improve the quality of life for all in the community, and we do that through partnerships. And I often say I would put our nonprofits up against any in the country, and we would be very, very proud as a community. They are doing critical, important work on shoestring budgets, and they do so with a smile every single day.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't share that Owens Community College's Early Learning Center on our Findlay campus is one of those recipients. It's a 5-star quality rated program, and we received a $5,000 grant from Handbags That Help Women's Giving Circle. And I want to say that was a year or two ago. But Handbags That Help is one of the programs that the Community Foundation supports and sponsors. And one was for the purchase of playground equipment, and then we received another grant this past year to implement a creative curriculum. And some of what that curriculum is going to do is to help students learn how to read early, to implement science of reading, all of those things. And it provides that for all of the people who work at the Early Learning Center. And so the partnership that we have with you on behalf of these young children, and then you think of that ripple effect, you know, if they have better access to quality childcare, you know, and what that means for their start in their lives in general, not just, you know, educationally speaking, it really goes on to have a profound effect that is amplified throughout their lives and through the gifts that the foundation was able to provide. And so thank you.
Of course. We are always excited about partnering with incredible programs. And Handbags That Help, or HTH, is a women's giving circle that has been around since 2008. And in that time frame, they have actually granted more than $770,000.
Oh, wow.
To organizations. We provide administrative and grant-making support. Ours is the behind-the-scenes easy work. What they do is they collect money and collect resources and then learn about our community and make decisions about where to distribute those funds. And when you look through the years, they've really funded some incredible projects. So we're proud to partner with them. And talking about the Early Learning Center and education, we think about it that any one intervention can change the trajectory of somebody's life. And in this case, that high-quality curriculum, let's say that it improves a student's KRA or kindergarten readiness score, what that could mean for that young person is access. Access to better education, access to training, access to perhaps higher education, which then means that that one intervention, investing in that young person, means that their life is forever changed. And then their kids, if they have kids, their lives are forever changed. And we never know what that intervention is that's going to have that life-changing effect. I think about young people a lot because they're, I think, one of the groups that has the most ability to be impacted by those changes.
Absolutely.
We did some work with the United Way a couple of years ago where we said, let's increase exposure to high quality pre-K.
Mm-hmm.
And the jump in the KRA scores was significant. That just having that high quality pre-K would make a difference. In essence, being ready for kindergarten and thriving. There's that difference. And that was just one of the interventions. We've seen it with Leader in Me throughout Hancock mm-hmm. County schools, that focus on soft skills could have a big, profound impact on young people and their readiness to enter whatever is next for them.
How do you deal with the sustainability of some of these initiatives? Like once you find out and you get data that this is really making a difference, what do you do next?
So typically early on in the grant-making process, we talk about that at the beginning. Sometimes what that means is that we have a shorter investment. Sometimes it means we have a longer investment. We do a lot of experimenting at the Community Foundation where somebody will come to us and we try to make an environment where people are comfortable with whatever the results of a mm-hmm. program may be, whether they be successful or whether they be learning opportunities. And it's that idea of if something is successful, do other partners join in? Once you have that data, it tends to be easier to get other partners, but it really depends on the program. If we increase and fund a little longer, if we encourage others to fund a little longer, or in some of the kindergarten readiness, it was the city and county school said, just give us time to try this experiment that we can cover the cost of intervention. If students are more ready, we will have less intervention costs, and we could perhaps then pay for additional early childhood or early pre-K work with some of those savings and intervention. Unfortunately, in the middle of that experiment, we had a global pandemic, mm-hmm. which made the data a little less clear, but we know that it made a difference in a lot of young people's lives.
That's just amazing. I would imagine that your second grade self would be really excited with what you're doing now, even though you're currently not a second grade teacher.
I still think I'm educating mm-hmm. every single day. You can never get rid of the educator, but I am proud of the work that we do in big and small ways. And it always shows up in the most interesting places. We worked with most of the local elementary schools in Hancock County to provide book vending machines, where instead of a trinket or a candy for good behavior, students earn a token and they get to get a book from the vending machine. And we were able to see the grand opening and the unveiling of some of these, and it was great, really proud of it. But it really hit home when my kid was able to get a book. And when she came home and was so excited about this book vending machine, and I couldn't stop smiling because to know I had heard about it and I had read it and I had seen it from a distance. But when your own young person is so excited because they saw the direct correlation between good leader behavior and a book. And so that was one of the times where it was like, okay, what we're doing is hitting home today.
Absolutely.
And that's fun.
That has to be so rewarding. And especially when you see your young person enjoying that.
She was so excited.
It became a first person experience.
Yes, yes. And then of course I'm telling everybody at work, I'm sure they loved the text messages, but she was so excited. And then of course pictures and it was a special day.
That is awesome. Well, so the educational piece is also, you know, from the early childhood learning center, but also for our college students, there are several scholarships that the Community Foundation has for students at Owens Community College. And I know that we're not the only higher education institution that you hold scholarships for. So can you talk about that part of the Community Foundation's work?
Sure. This year, we are celebrating mm-hmm. our 30th anniversary. And in the spring, we awarded our 30th cycle of scholarships.
Oh, congratulations. That is a wonderful milestone.
It is. It is. And we have a variety of scholarships. We're always thankful to our partners, mm-hmm. Owens being one of them. Our scholarships meet a variety of needs, whether mm-hmm. it be two-year, four-year technical or trade skills, some for postgraduate. We have a scholarship for medical missions for students that are going on a medical mission trip. Those scholarships in that time frame, in those 30 years, we've awarded more than $7 million mm-hmm. in student support. And I think about each of those students and what that means for them. Because mm-hmm. I had scholarships mm-hmm. to help earn a bachelor's and to lessen the burden on my family. And I know that that made a difference. Mm-hmm. And I know that for my parents, we started a scholarship for them before mm-hmm. my mom passed away, where it was all about growing up after college. My parents always talked about the type of student that I was and having a scholarship to help students like me. Not the 4.0s, not the students that had unlimited aid unlocked, but students that were just average students who cared, who were involved in activities, who were doing something outside of the classroom. So for my dad and my mom's memory, we started a scholarship.
That is
and
wonderful.
We set parameters, and we've been able to award that twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, again, one of those first-hand experiences.
Yeah.
It's very different awarding a scholarship in an award banquet mm-hmm. and awarding one in your parents' honor. And those make a difference in anything that we can do to help unlock the ability for students to see a pathway to whatever it is that's next, whether it's, you know, entering the workforce, whether it's going on to higher education, anything that we can do to unlock that ability to follow their dreams, I think is important.
That is amazing. Unlocking the ability to follow your dreams. I think that should be your new tagline. So we're excited about the partnership that we have with the University of Findlay, our Oiler Express. And one of the things that I really enjoy about working with the University of Findlay and with President Fell is that she very much takes a broad higher education view and understands how effective partnerships can be when it comes to making sure people have what it is that they need to succeed in life.
I have great respect for both of you.
Oh, thank you.
And in your organizations, I think we're lucky as a community to have, we're a smaller community, Hancock County, but we have two incredibly high quality institutions to pursue higher education. And I think the easy part is to talk about all of the technical things that people learn
mm-hmm.
when they're pursuing a degree. Like those skills that will make somebody more job ready. But what I think is the profound impact of having Owens and University of Findlay both in Hancock County
mm-hmm.
are all of the other skills,
mm-hmm.
the higher education. And spoken as a true student affairs person.
And you know, I totally understand what you're saying.
We need to acknowledge that a college and a university setting, a place where people learn about communication,
mm-hmm.
they learn about leadership, they learn about problem solving, critical thinking. And really important right now is that idea of civil discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Owens Community College and University of Findlay are both places where students can practice those skills,
mm-hmm.
where they can speak in rough draft and figure out how to eloquently and effectively talk about the values and beliefs that they hold.
Absolutely.
And that they have every right to hold, and also interact with somebody whose values and beliefs may not be the same as theirs.
Absolutely.
In workforce and in life. Having two institutions of higher education, how lucky are we that we live in a community where two places are mm-hmm. actively teaching and training students those skills that we need so critically in our communities.
Thank you so much. And I couldn't have said it better, because we spend a lot of time talking about making sure that we have a community of belonging where mm-hmm. everyone can see themselves, where everyone is welcome, where everyone can thrive, and being able to open yourself to different ideas, different possibilities, and to be able to have that conversation with someone whose life experience may be totally different, or maybe not even one that you've even considered or thought about before. And I think that that's one of the great values of higher education, is because we provide a very intentional space for those conversations to occur.
And a safe place for people to explore thoughts mm-hmm. and explore beliefs and explore their own and identify their own principles and beliefs. And that's really powerful. And we're so lucky to have that in Hancock County.
Thank you. I mean, one of the things that we get really excited about is our reading program called The Big Read. And it's a college-wide annual event where students actually suggest the topic They suggest the topic that they want to learn more about. And then a group of faculty come together to figure out, okay, what are some authors that have written about this and how can we infuse this throughout the curriculum? And so this year is about a woman who discloses her journey with understanding her own autism.
Wow.
And so there's book clubs that meet regularly. There's the author will come to campus and speak in the spring. High schoolers will come to campus. Community members are invited. The thing I love about it the most is that the students are the ones saying, we want to learn more about this. Last year, the author talked about deaf culture. The year before, the author talked about mental health trauma. And so it's all of these big ideas, you know, giant cultures that our students are hungry to learn more about. And our faculty work with them and our staff work with them to figure out, okay, what are the ways in which we can bring this alive for you? And so I think it's just that kind of thing in particular, because a lot of times when we talk about, you know, civic discourse and things of this nature, you know, a lot of times the default assumption is that it's about politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is true as well. But there's so many aspects to being a human being to where it doesn't always have to be about that one thing. It can be about so many different aspects of our lives.
And so for your students, mm-hmm. having that opportunity where they all have different life experiences
mm-hmm.
that have led them to where they are on campus today.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take this common book, this common read,
mm-hmm.
that then they all apply their own lenses
exactly.
to that. And you provide spaces to have the discussion. That's something then that, yes, the topic of the year is important.
Mm-hmm.
But just as important as how they'll apply that then in future,
for
in
the
future
rest
experiences.
Of their lives.
That's really profound.
It is truly one of my favorite programs that we have.
Any spoiler alerts on what next year's topic will be, or is it too soon?
We don't know. And quite honestly, the program is led by one of our faculty and our head librarian, and they don't tell us in advance. Sometimes they will let the provost know, and so sometimes I'll have a sneak peek into the topic, but there's a big reveal. And so there's literally an auditorium, and people are filling the auditorium to find out what the topic is and who the speaker will be. And our foundation is involved and engaged in helping people get the book, because there tends to be a lot of the books that are being ordered and, you know, for different folks. And so it really is a major undertaking. And, you know, not only the work they do in the community, but they'll host, you know, reading events in community libraries with children. I mean, it really is a big deal. And so we get really excited about it.
Kudos to
Thank
everyone
you.
Who's involved in keeping that going.
We're proud of the big read.
As you should be.
Thank you. But I think what you're saying about higher education and the value that it provides can't be overstated. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the role that higher education plays. And I think that helping people hone a variety of universal skills, granted, there are multiple places in which that learning can occur, but I think that the collegiate environment provides a perfect space for those things to occur.
And I think we both probably have experiences where something we did at the college or university level has influenced and has kept with us mm-hmm. and skills that we still use in our roles today.
Absolutely. Before we end the podcast, I have to ask you about your dissertation
okay.
because the topic was about humor. And so can you talk about how it is you landed on that? And honestly, what were some of your key findings?
So yes, humor was the topic of my dissertation. And people hear that and then all of a sudden have these high expectations that I'm funny. And then they're disappointed shortly thereafter. I knew that I would spend well over a year or two with this topic. And so I tried out some really heavy topics.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't think about spending 2 years on those topics. So then I started looking at humor, and humor is a leadership quality. And I'm like, okay, I'll be able to power through and still love the topic. I can't promise that actually happened. I think anybody who's done a dissertation knows that after a couple months, it becomes a bit more challenging. So I did a study on individuals in four fields: business, education, government, and the nonprofit sector.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at two big questions. their preference for working with a leader who uses humor as a leadership quality, and then how they rank, in essence, humor compared to other leadership qualities. And I expected to find some sort of difference between the four fields, and I did not. So there was no statistically significant difference in how the four preferred working with a leader who uses humor, and they all, individuals in all four of those areas, preferred it. And then the rankings, there was actually very little difference in how they ranked humor compared to technical knowledge, communication. So it was fascinating, fascinating process. Anybody who's done a dissertation can tell you, you learn a lot about yourself and perseverance and grit and working through the topic. I am glad I did it, but I'm not lining up necessarily to do that again.
So, all right, I realize this is a technical question. How did you define humor?
Humor is a tough one, but it's that purposeful intention to elicit a positive, comical, or laugh response.
Okay.
So, and humor appropriately can be a really powerful tool to bring people together. So part of the research was what humor works, what humor doesn't, when humor can be used appropriately to bring people together.
That is absolutely fascinating because there's the skillfulness with which one does or does not impart humor. I'm assuming that would have to be part of the effectiveness challenge, is
it? Definitely. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Because you can, if somebody uses it appropriately, humor can elicit this unifying positive response. When used inappropriately or not effectively, it can either have a negative response or a mixed response. And so there's surprisingly a lot of research out there about humor. If you're ever really interested in a rabbit hole, there are lots of them that you can go on when it comes to humor.
Really, no joke.
Yeah, seriously, seriously.
Brian, thank you so much for being here. It was such a joy talking to you, getting to know more about your story and about the Community Foundation. We're proud to partner with you.
Same. It's always good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you. Brian, thank you so much for being with us today. We're so incredibly grateful to you for your hard work and leadership on behalf of the Findlay community. Thank you for your support and your time today. And thank you to all of our listeners. Please remember to subscribe and join us for future conversations. Until next time, take care.